I'm John Kroll. The Indiana Youth Institute is holding its annual Kids Count Conference today and tomorrow. On No Limits today, we're going to talk about ways that we can help at-risk young people overcome obstacles and develop. My guests are Glenn Augustine of IYI, Dr. Lamar Shields, president of the Combio Group and a faculty member at Johns Hopkins, and Shanae Watkins, who spent much of her teen years behind bars for stabbing another girl when she was 12. Her story of redemption is featured in the film Girlhood, screening as part of the conference. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about at-risk young people. The Indiana Youth Institute is holding its annual Kids Count Conference today and tomorrow, and that's sort of the springboard for our conversation today. If you would like to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Glenn Augustine of the Indiana Youth Institute, Dr. Lamar Shields, who is here from Baltimore, where he is the president of the Combio Group and a member of the Johns Hopkins family, and Shanae Watkins, who we're going to hear a lot of her story, spent much of her teen years behind bars for stabbing another girl when she was 12. Her story has been transferred. Well, you've done both a book and been part of a movie called Girlhood that is going to be shown as part of the conference. So we're going to talk a lot about her story as well. Welcome to all of you. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks for having us, man.
Thanks, John.
Certainly. Well, I probably ought to start with Glenn. Talk with me a little bit about what the Kids Count Conference is.
Well, John, because Kids Count Conference, presented by Pacers Foundation, is a statewide conference, we bring about 1,700 to 1,800 youth workers, mostly from across the state, to Indianapolis for 2.5 days of inspiration, information. They're speaking to the best experts across the country. We literally scour the country, finding the best experts in youth development to talk about the latest trends, best practices, tools and techniques they can go back. We've had people, John, leave at lunch to go back to an emergency situation at their organizations, put something they've learned in the morning to work and come back in the afternoon. That's no lie. That's how good this conference is. And I say that not to brag. We hear from people like Lamar that this is one of the best conferences in the country of its kind. And it is because of people like Lamar who come back to us year after year with new material. And it really is just trying to make sure that the youth workers of Indiana go back out there to work with children best prepared to handle those tough situations and give children that sense of hope that they need and belief in themselves to achieve in life.
And I probably ought to ask this question. If there is someone who works with young people who gets inspired by this program and wants to scoot to the conference, is it still possible to attend or reservations closed?
No, they can still register on site. You go to the Indiana Convention Center, and downstairs on the first floor right off of Maryland Street is our registration booth. They can still go check in and pay the on-site registration fee. They'd get a day and a half. And today, still some great speakers and workshops until 5:30 this afternoon, and then all day tomorrow again.
And real quickly, what is that registration, on-site registration?
$150.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to talk about the larger subject, the reason we are all here, which is talking about young people who are at risk. And I always find it useful when we start these conversations to make sure that we have some idea of the terms we're throwing. How at risk is one of those phrases that is thrown around somewhat casually, and it can mean, everything from children who are living in war zones, to much more posh circumstances. Mm-hmm. So, Lamar, I'm going to start with you. Give me a definition of at risk, what we're talking about.
You bring up a great point. You know, I work at the Center for Violence Prevention at Johns Hopkins. I've worked in the past, and so through the CDC-funded program. And I don't like to use the term at risk. I rather use at promise, because we all are at risk to something. We want to move away from a deficit model. Mm. IYI, what they're doing, the Kids Count Conference, is about moving away from the deficit model. We're always talking about what kids aren't doing. We want to talk about the great things that they're doing. So the at-risk model is somewhat changed. I know people use that a lot, but I think at promise, at hope are sort of stronger terms that we could use. And I'm attempting to change that trajectory of how we view young people, not only just here in Indiana, but across the country. So I'm mindful of that. But if you talk about the term at risk, I mean, when you look at the horrible stats about young people, not only just in urban environments, but environments across the country, they're dismal. I mean, we learn a lot about a country by the way it treats its young people. And we don't treat our young people well in this country. IYI, I think this may be their 25th or 26th year doing the Kids Count Conference. Am I correct?
15 years with the conference, okay. And 27 years we've been doing this work in business. Yeah.
And so they're doing – when he was talking mm-hmm. about how this conference is inspiring and motivating people, I'm at about 100 conferences a year. This is one of my favorite ones, because we're very mindful about the terms that we use as we identify and talk about young people. And young people are mindful. They don't like to hear those terms that we're at risk. Well, like mm-hmm. I said, well, let's say they're at promise. Let's provide them with a level of hope, because, again – if the youth service providers, the people that are responsible for those young people, if we can't give them positive words and positive terms, then they're going to go back into that same situation. So we want to sort of shift that. There's a debate about that. But again, when you look at dropout rate, when you look at suspension rate, young people are catching hell all over this country.
Well, and I guess
so
where
we have to change that. Yeah.
Where I'm going, it's also trying to figure out the scope of the problem. I know here in Indiana, courtesy of the Indiana Youth Institute, we know that 22% of the state's children live in poverty,
indeed,
for example. So the terms, when we talk about these kids that might need a little more
indeed
attention or a little more help than they receive, I don't want to currently are receiving. How large is Indiana typical, or is poverty one of the definers
poverty,
of the kids we want
to
reach?
So you have to be very clear. Poverty is an issue. You know, race, culture, and class is an issue. Gender is an issue. I just left doing a panel discussion around girls. When you talk about girls globally across the world, you know, they're not in school. They're at home because, you know, they can't get jobs. They're being abused, verbally, sexually abused. So it's a huge problem. So conferences like this is very, very important. But then it's also what makes this conference unique. You know, young people are not here, but we're also providing strategies, specific strategies for providers who are coming from all over the state who are too, many of them are at risk. Many of them are at risk individuals. Shanae, who's going to talk shortly, I mean, she's now providing strategies for girls so they don't have to go down that same road. And so why this conference is so successful is because some of the people that are here, they come out of those situations. And I think the people that have come out of those situations that, you know, that we deem at risk, they're more qualified outside of the degrees that they have and those things. But because they have the empirical data that supports, I've gone through hell as a young person. I know what it feels like. I don't like what it feels like. But the numbers are high. I can spew, you know, as a researcher, I can spew numbers all over the place. But the reality is we're starting to see a shift, and I'm loving the shift that we're going in. Do we need to do more work? Yes, we do. But there's a major shift that's taking place where young people now are at the table having those conversations, because what gets under my skin a lot, and they're doing it different, is we talk about young people, but they're not in the room.
Yeah.
So we just leave the conference, and we're talking about working with girls, but you have four girls at the table because they're the experts. So we have to, for those people that are listening, if young people are not at the table, then we can't change the trajectory of how they're being viewed, because the way that they're seeing things are totally different from the way that we see things as researchers and providers.
Yes. And Shanae, whatever the term we use, at promise or at risk, we were talking about you at one time, right? Mm-hmm. We were talking about your circumstances. I hate doing this because I think it's almost demeaning to people to ask them to boil down their life experience to two or 3 minutes of conversation. But could you talk a little bit about, you know, the circumstances that first led you into trouble? I mean, as you say, you stabbed another girl at age 12, and you were imprisoned for that.
Right.
But you're in an entirely different place now.
Yes.
So we talk a little bit about where you were, what sort of situation you were in when you were led to that real time of trouble, and then how we turn things around.
Well, I think that that's really important, especially when you talk about youth that are, I guess, quote unquote, at risk, because in my household, I had one of those lifestyles where I didn't have everything, but I never really lacked anything. Mm-hmm. You know, like sometimes when you think of a child who's at risk or you think of a child who you want to help, it's that little girl or little boy who doesn't have food at home, who doesn't have the basic necessities. And in my situations, that wasn't me. I had a parent who worked two jobs to provide. What put me at risk was that I didn't have the proper supervision.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also one of the things, you know, I like to tell people it can happen to anybody's child, because here I have two parents in my life who work, they're law-abiding citizens, but because you don't have those proper programs and you don't have that proper supervision for your child, they sort of stray off. So for me, at around the age of 10 years old, I started to, I started to experiment with alcohol. And that came about because I spent a lot of times around my older cousins. They were experimenting. We didn't have any adults around. And, you know, I got mixed up into that. And due to, number one, as I said, the lack of supervision and wanting attention, that drove me into the streets to look for attention. So at this point, 10 and 11 years old, I'm addicted to alcohol. I'm running away because I want attention from anybody who I can get it from. I stopped going to school. Even though I didn't have a reason, I wasn't struggling in school. I just stopped going to school because I was more into the streets than I was anything else. And due to me being in the streets and being a runaway and doing things that I have no business doing at that age, I ended myself in a situation with another young woman over a grown man where we got into a fight that necessarily wasn't even something that I wanted to do. I called myself being a peacemaker, but I made a lot of wrong decisions in that particular situation. I carried a knife, so I had a weapon on me. I was in the streets when I should have been in school. And as a result of that fight, I stabbed her and she lost her life. And I ended up in a juvenile detention center.
The grown man that were you both involved with him?
Yes.
Is that the context? Okay, so it really was, to some degree, a young life that had really run off the rails. You were making a lot of self-destructive choices.
It was, but you know, the reality of that is that I used to look at it back then and I say, I can't believe that I was doing those things at 11 and 12 years old, but when you look at it, there's so many young women in this country,
yeah.
I mean, in this city, I'm sure, as well as in Baltimore City where I'm from, that's doing the same thing. Like, it's become a new norm. And so I think one of the biggest things for me that I started to believe is that we have to find a better way to catch them. When I was younger, they thought about talking to you about sex and about love and about alcohol abuse when you were in middle school. At this point, you have to catch them way earlier. And that's where the training for the staff and the teachers and the people who work with youth comes in.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about, although there's some dispute over the term, at-risk children. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, Shanae, you were 12 years old, and you ended up going to a juvenile detention center. How long were you in?
I was there for 4 years.
4 years.
Mm-hmm. And it was a situation where I had to be weaned. I couldn't, because of the charges that I had and because of so many things that happened prior to me being arrested, I had to go from the detention center to a group home and then home.
Okay, so you had 4 years, though, when you were in custody, and this was from age 12 to age 16.
Mm-hmm.
And you came out at 16, I mean, this is another, we've done shows on this too. You come out and there really aren't that many support systems in place to keep you from going right back to what you were doing before. Was that the pattern for you?
Definitely. And I lost my mom a few weeks after I was released as well. So, I think that there needs to be better support systems for young women, especially when they're returning to society.
And in that time, I mean, when you came out, did you drift back to the street? You said you'd lost your mom. Did you return to school? Presumably you got some schooling. They forced you to go to school probably while you were in custody, right?
Right. I returned to school. I did pretty well in school. I still had some things that I was battling with. You know, I did a up and down. I didn't return to full rebellion as I had been prior to being arrested, but I still dealt with some things that teenagers would do. I still dealt with some issues once I was returned.
We're going to hear more of your story after a break. We are talking about at-risk youth or at-promise youth here on No Limits. My guests are Glenn Augustine of the Indiana Youth Institute, Lamar Shields, who is with the Combio Group, and Johns Hopkins, and Shanae Watkins, who is featured in the film Girlhood. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about at-risk or at-promise young people here on No Limits today. My guests are Glenn Augustine of the Indiana Youth Institute and Dr. Lamar Shields of the Combio Group and Johns Hopkins, and Shanae Watkins, with whom we were talking just before the break. She spent several of her teen years behind bars for stabbing another girl when she was young, a 12-year-old. Her story of redemption was made into a movie called Girlhood, which is screening as part of the conference. You've also written a book, and I want to get to that as well. But, Glenn, I probably ought to ask, since there is a movie here, and if people have their appetites whetted and they want to see the movie after listening to Shanae, how do they go about doing that?
The film will be screened tonight at 6:30 p.m. Check-in time is at 6 at the Marriott downtown. That's at 350, I believe it is, on Maryland Street, right across from the convention center. And folks just need to show up. It's first come, first serve. We have a number of tickets left. And the film will start at 6:30, and there'll be a panel discussion following with Lamar and Shanae. So really a great opportunity to see the film and to dive into this topic further.
And what is the ticket price?
It is free.
It is free. Okay. All right. Well, you can't argue with that.
No.
So. Well, Shanae, I want to come back to you and sort of work through the narrative here. It sounds like when you were released and came back at 16 – it wasn't necessarily an even path for you getting back on your feet. We probably ought to point out that this was not yesterday. You are, if my research is correct, you're 30 years old now,
yes,
right?
I am.
So we're talking about something that happened nearly 20 years ago in the first place and 14 or 15 years ago now. So what led you back to a productive life? I mean, you're now quite happy. You got 3 children, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I'll tell you what. I'll stop telling your story.
No, it's all right. Okay.
I'll stop telling your story and let you tell it.
I mean, for me, what it was, well, first and foremost, I had to make some decisions for myself. You know, when my mom passed away, I didn't know what to feel. I was still in one of those states where I had a hard time feeling things. I had a hard time feeling remorse when I was arrested. I had a hard time feeling when my mom passed away. And I just had to sit down and make a decision of whether or not I wanted to go forward or I wanted to allow it to pull me back. There's one point in the documentary where I say that I try to avoid thinking about my mom, because if I did, it would cause me to drink and smoke again, and I wanted to continue on with my life. So after that, it was really trial and error. You know, I fell a lot of times, but I got up every single time. I think that one of the hardest things for me was that when I was released at 16, you have to think, I went in at 12 years old, I had already been raped, I had been molested, I had been addicted to marijuana, to alcohol, I had been pregnant, by the time I was 12 years old. And so I came out 4 years later, and true, it was 4 years, but 4 years isn't hardly enough time to, you know, deal with all that trauma. But you come out, and it's 4 years later, and I think that sometimes people think because you spent that amount of time behind bars, you must be magically healed. And that's part of the reason that I wrote the book, too. But when I came out, it's like, everybody looked at it thinking that it should be that one way. Like, you've been gone all this time, you should be straight. But it didn't really happen that way sometimes. Sometimes it was a hard road. Sometimes I still made some decisions that a 17 or 18-year-old would make. Sometimes I still didn't want to go to school, but I did go to school. And I graduated, like, number two or three in my class. After that, I had children. And when I had my children, that was the biggest thing for me that made me say, you know what? I have a child in this world, and I have to make sure that I get it together. I keep it together. Looking at them every day and knowing that I'm responsible for them every day drives me. Like, right now, I work two jobs. I travel sometimes, and I speak at conferences like this. I'm still working on my book. But doing all of those things, it's like looking at my children that drives me to be able to stay on the right path.
How did the movie come about?
So we were in the detention center. It's called Cheltenham. And I saw the film crew. And I'm like, hey, this film crew is here. What are they doing here? And so I just walk up to the lady and I ask her. I say, you know, what are you doing here? What are you guys doing? And she says, we're doing a documentary on the boys. And I said, well, you should do something on the girls. And she came over to the girls' unit, and she inquired about some of the stories of the girls. And she must have been really intrigued, because when you walk in there, you just see a bunch of young women. I mean, very pretty and sweet young girls. No one was violent. We didn't fight each other. It was like a family. But behind those very pretty and sweet young girls, you have one girl who a woman owed her money, so and she went into her house in the middle of the night and shot her. You got one girl who was getting jumped by a few girls, and she stabbed two of them, you know, and she has a murder charge as well. So I think that intrigued her and pushed her to do the documentary on the girls, and she never did that documentary she was planning on doing on the boys.
So how did she focus on you? Was it because of that first conversation, or?
Yeah, it was because of the first conversation. I think that after inquiring about what I was there for, you know, she probably wanted to see what more she could get. We had this big round table meeting in the beginning of the documentary, and we were talking about our charges while we were there. And there was this really powerful moment with me where I was really upset because I felt like my case was publicized. It was on the radio, it was in the news. And when people don't know you and it's in the media, what you hear is, this child must be an absolute mess. She's a mass murderer. She hunted someone down and she killed them. She's the worst person. She deserves to be in jail and locked away. We are her parents. Her parents must be really bad parents. And I was really upset about that because I had two parents who not only loved me and worked hard for me, but prior to being arrested, prior to being in trouble, they had taken me to just about every program they could in the city to try to get me help. They took me to Hopkins. They took me to Kennedy Creek. They took me to social services. They took me to the police offices. And everyone said, we can't do anything with you. We can't help you until she breaks the law. And then when I broke the law, they said, well, wait a minute. Where were you? You must be bad parents. And so at that point, I was really upset because I felt like people were seeing me, number one, differently than what I was. And they were judging me without knowing the whole story. And I think that hearing what I felt in regards to my charges, in regards to my life, made them feel like they wanted to focus on me. And they had a few other girls who they worked with, but it narrowed down to myself and another girl by the name of Megan, who has an awesome story as well.
We are talking on No Limits today about young people who are often in desperate circumstances. My guests are Glenn Augustine of the Indiana Youth Institute, which is holding its annual Kids Count Conference today and tomorrow. Dr. Lamar Shields, the Combio Group in Johns Hopkins, and Shanae Watkins, whose story is the subject of a film, Girlhood, that sort of incorporates many of the elements that we're talking about here. Lamar, it would be comforting to think that the Cheney story is an isolated one, but it is not, unfortunately.
It's not. And first of all, I'm just so proud of Cheney. We've been traveling doing this work all over the country, and it just made sense. I was so intrigued by her story. She stole the show because she was this cute little girl that talked so much. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if you're a filmmaker, you're like, I want to gravitate towards her. So I'm sitting here smiling, not because what she did.
Works
but
well
I'm
on radio,
here,
too.
I'm sitting here smiling because, you know, I'm just watching this young lady blossom and mature. I've been working with her for years. Mm-hmm. And we've been working on the story and shaping this story. And she's still going through this. You know, what we know as researchers, we talk about trauma-informed care. And Sinead talked about trauma quite a bit in what she said. And one of the biggest mistakes, and you said this is not isolated, it is not isolated because, you know, 1 in 3 girls are being incarcerated faster than boys are. And she talked about trauma. And so it's how do we look at trauma-informed care? And so trauma-informed care is when I look at Sinead, I don't say to Sinead, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
I say to you, Sinead, what happened to you? Because if I say to you, what's wrong with you, then she puts up these defenses. But if I say, Sinead, what happened to you, then she starts to tell her story. Understand, as Sinead travels and I'm with her and we're watching this film, she's being traumatized all over again. Mm-hmm. Understand that as from a psychology standpoint.
She has to relive the experience.
She has to relive that, and we have to be very mindful of when we're bringing folks here. We have to provide them with those strategies and those techniques to deal with that because, again, she is reenacting this over and over and over again. Even though she's a 30-year-old woman now, she's still a little girl, and you can see it in her face trapped inside of her. So I want to encourage any mom that's listening or any dad, we want you to bring your daughter to this because this is going to be a powerful conversation after you see this film. But then to hear the things that she needed, because you hear when you talk about at risk, at risk is about a kid who's needing some things.
Yeah.
She's not getting the things, or there's this desire that she's not getting at home, but there's something else. And that those streets, they think that they're paved with gold. And in her eyes, she wanted to be out there. And so she learned a valuable lesson. But we don't want the girls that's listening to this station now, or the moms, we don't want those little girls to have to go down this same road. We want you to watch the film. We want you to learn from Sinead. But this is not an isolated. I'm from Chicago, you know, a city that's dealing with a lot of issues.
Yeah.
And as I'm driving down the street, I'm looking at girls and wondering, could that be Sinead? You know, I brought her to speak to a group of kids in one part of Baltimore.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, Lamar, it's interesting. You have me speaking here because this is the neighborhood at 11. I'm thinking as a father, when I started working with her, I didn't have any children. So now I'm thinking, what do I need to do to protect my own children? And so we have to look at the role that trauma is playing, not only on the children that we're working with, but then also the children that are observing what Sinead is going through, because our children are watching us. And so moms and dads and teachers that are out there, we want you to come see this film. We're going to have a very transparent conversation. But, you know, my work now is shifting. It's around trauma-informed care. What can we do to better engage these young people that are dealing with trauma? Could you imagine this on a day-to-day basis? We're talking about refugees coming into this country. They're reacting to stuff over and over and over again. She's playing this out. So I always tell Sinead, we talk about you need to be on a couch. You need to have a therapist while you're providing therapy because she's dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. And now she has little girls of her own that are watching how she's engaging other girls.
Well, and we've got a lot of directions we could go with this because what you're talking about, we've done shows on it. Adverse childhood experiences, which, you know, has, I think, one of the most misleading acronyms of all time, ACE. It's not, you know, it's not a high point for anyone. So I'd like to stay with you for a second, maybe get Glenn to chime in a little bit. What these adverse childhood experiences, what the cumulative effect on young people can be. And then, Sinead, I'm going to want to ask you a little bit about what it is like for you to have to relive that part of your life, because you know, I'm making a judgment having known you now for all of maybe 40 minutes, but you seem very happy and very settled, very comfortable with yourself and in your skin, and all of that being dragged back to a part of your life where you were none of those things
right.
Can't be entirely pleasant. But let's talk, get some idea of what these adverse childhood experiences do to young
people.
Well,
one thing I would like to throw out, you know, is PTSD that we're hearing a lot, post-traumatic stress disorder. We're seeing this amongst servicemen. We're seeing this amongst people that come into this country. You know, kids are coming into our classrooms, and I'm a teacher by trade. I started there. With they're having these violent situations in their home, and as teachers, we say, we want you to come into the classroom. I want you to take this test, the Common Core. And this kid is like, hey, man, my mother was just raped yesterday. Or, hey, I was just shot on the way into school, you know, or I was just robbed. And we're expecting kids to bounce back from situations that even as adults – we're unable to bounce back from. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing a high rate of alcoholism. We're seeing a high suspension rate of black and brown children at a greater rate than anyone else. We're seeing girls being expelled, kicked out of school at a greater rate than we ever saw. Because we turned a blind eye to our girls and we focus on our boys, but while the boy focused on our boys, the girls were getting into trouble. We're seeing girls being incarcerated at a greater rate. We're seeing them getting caught up with drug dealing and drug dealers because the drug dealers are having the girls, I want you to carry something for me. So there's a direct effect of what Shanae is talking about in the classroom, in the streets. The high rate of homelessness amongst teens is insane right now. Mm-hmm. And it's because of all of these issues that they're dealing with that they're not finding someone that they can connect with. We found out through the Bill and Melinda Gates research is that young people, when they interview young people in the school system, young people said they just needed a person to connect with. And if we can teach educators and providers what you can do to connect, you don't have to go down the same road as Shanae, but just being a listening ear to say, I don't understand what you've gone through, but I'm just going to make myself available and support you in that process.
Glenn.
It, just one thing, we do want people to come to that movie tonight, but anybody 13, under 18, needs to be with an adult. This film is not a feel-good story. It deals with some serious issues, and so we want people to come into this with their eyes wide open about what they're going to see. There's some very disturbing and adult content, and that we want to engage. We want parents to bring their children so that they can engage in those difficult but important conversations, and that's what the panel discussion we hope will start for families. But we do want parents to know if you're bringing a teenager to that, please be mindful of the fact that you're going to probably get into some things you maybe not have in your home. John, you know, at the Indiana Youth Institute, we work with the youth workers. That's what we're there to do is to equip them so they can do a better job when they go out into their communities. And Lamar mentioned trauma-informed care. We do something across the state called youth worker cafes or little lunch and learns. And youth workers are so stressed for time and money. This is free, and it's only an hour and a half. So they come to these in droves. And trauma-informed care is one of the most requested and attended of the topics we do for these youth worker cafes. The other piece to that is, you know, what Lamar's talking about, it's happening everywhere in the state of Indiana. It's not just happening in our cities.
Yeah.
When you look at what's happening with heroin and other drugs out in the rural areas of Indiana and the scourge that's become, that's a lot.
Well, who would have thought Scott County would become, yeah.
Right, and that's because of the hopelessness these young people feel in these communities because of what Lamar's talking about. They just need somebody to connect with. So a couple of things. We'd like to see people get involved in mentoring. We have a website, abetterhour.org. You can go on to abetterhour.org, which is the Indiana Mentoring Partnership's website. Put your zip code in there and find a mentoring opportunity near you. You can save a child's life by becoming their mentor, but you're going to get more out of it than the child is going to get. So there are ways for people to get involved to help these children and help them realize the promise that they have. And so the other piece of this is what we're also finding is that many of the youth workers who are out there in the field, they are not fully equipped to understand that some of the children they have coming to them have mental health issues. And we also know that getting mental health care is very difficult. There are a shortage of providers, so it's hard to get an appointment. It's expensive, oftentimes not covered under health insurance programs. So the youth worker out there who is often working with these children is trying to handle a myriad of issues, not always well equipped to do that. So that's the kind of information we're trying to get out. We also hope that people like Shanae and Lamar, through both their workshops and the movie, will show that this is so. There's so many layers to this. We can't fathom them all, but we have to look at it from that role of what mental health might play, and also that trauma is so vitally important in how it affects children.
We're getting close. We'll pick this up after the break. We are talking about children who are in desperate circumstances. My guests are Glenn Augustine of the Indiana Youth Institute, Dr. Lamar Shields of the Combio Group, and Johns Hopkins University, and Shanae Watkins, who is the subject of a film called Girlhood. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about young people who are in often desperate circumstances and how we help them achieve their potential. The springboard for the conversation is the Indiana Youth Institute's annual Kids Count Conference, which is going on today and tomorrow. We're talking with Shanae Watkins, who is the subject of a film called Girlhood, which will be shown tonight as part of the conference. My other guests are Glenn Augustine of the Indiana Youth Institute and Dr. Lamar Shields of the Combio Group and Johns Hopkins University. I always want to go John rather than Johns Hopkins there. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can reach out to us via Twitter at WFYI or find us on Facebook, as a listener named Gary has done, at nolimits@wfyi. And Gary says, were the mentors at school overpromising what they would do to help the guest as a child? Shanae, I think that one's directed to you.
With me, I didn't really have any mentors at school. The people who did come in to help me and I was really grateful for was after I was arrested. So the detention center that I went to was filled with staff members who really cared about us. They sat down and had real conversations with us that we probably should have had at home. A lot of us didn't have from our mothers. We had one male staff member who was amazing to have on the unit because a lot of the girls didn't have a father figure to look up to, or even, to be honest, a man that you could trust, because a lot of these young women are going through the system, be it school, foster care, group home, or detention center. And the men, the teachers, the counselors who are involved are just as much predators as the men in the street. And so it was really important for us to have a man within our unit that we could trust, as well as our counselors. They were amazing. Every promise that they made to me, they kept. They stayed with me even into my adult years. When I had children, when I graduated, when my mom passed away, they were always there, even though it was way beyond their job. When I was released, they didn't have to have anything else to do with me, but they always showed up when it was really important.
You said, and this is something that kind of haunts me, because it sounds like your parents were trying.
They were.
At some level. And you went through a list of people that they took you to. Why were you resistant to that kind of intervention at that age? And I'm not asking that in a challenging way, because I think that gets at it. It sounds like the mechanisms we use often to reach out aren't particularly effective either.
Right. What I learned, and I didn't learn this until I was much older, in my late 20s, I'm sorry. I was addicted to attention. So I knew that when my mom took me into this therapist, or she took me to Johns Hopkins or to Kennedy Krieger, the way that I could get more attention there, because all the rest of the children were bad there too. You know, they were acting out there too. So the way that I could get attention there was to not misbehave, mm-hmm. to be the good one there. So at home, it was just me. I can act out there. That's how I'm going to get attention. But once I'm in these positions and I'm in these places that my parents are taking me to, I'm the model child. And so then they're looking at my parents and they're like, well, what is wrong with you? But see, even in that, that's something that they're missing. Because you can't always only look at the child who's acting out all the time. Look at the little girl who always wants to be perfect, mm-hmm. who always wants to please everybody, who says, here, I did this on time, I did that on time, I got this right, I got that right, because she's crying out for attention too. And so I think that that mixed my parents up a lot when I was able to, when they were looking to get me help.
We've got another Facebook question from a listener named Robert, who says, and if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Says Shanae Watkins pointed out an important fact. Adult information is even more easy to get at any age, but adult thought isn't attached. The most important adult thought children need is caution, cause and effect. Are there any new methods, such as music, that get that message to them sooner? Lamar.
So essentially, I'm sitting here as Shanae talked about perfect. I'm thinking Beyonce's song Pretty Hurts, which talks about these personal challenges of being pretty and always trying to please the opposite sex, and now sometimes the same sex. I use a lot of music quite often. You know, I write about hip-hop culture. I use cultural norms to engage young people to have these serious conversations about how are you being viewed by music. We have to be culturally relevant. I think that why many programs don't work is we have these 8-track programs, you know, in music. 8-tracks are not coming back. This is an MP3 world. And when I go and evaluate programs.
Vinyl is, though.
Yeah, vinyl is another word. But they're running these 8-track,
scratching.
They're running these 8-track programs with MP3 kids. And so there's really, really no connection. And so music is, I mean, music is this universal message. Today I played a song by NDIRE called Video, and she's talking about she's not the typical video queen. She doesn't have the curves. And the four girls on the panel said that was the very first time they've heard that. They said, that's me. That's me. I'm not the typical girl. I don't have those type of things. So for them to see themselves, you know, Shanae talking about attention, in order for her to be what she wanted to be, she need to see it. And quite often, many of the girls that grow up in these ghettos and these barrios, they don't really see what they want. And so they look for something else. And then when it comes into their face, like all the other women that start to show up, then she said, that's what I want to aspire to. So she started getting these other people. But again, if you don't open yourself up to this saying, I want to do something and be something different, then it won't really come to you. And so adults are very responsible for what really happens.
Well, and I guess where I want to go with this, too, because Robert raises what I think is an important question here. We now know through a lot of the research and the development of the brain and all of that, that, you know, that the development of our brains and our ability to process a lot of things isn't complete until we're about 25. And sadly, and I might add, this makes my own teenage years a lot more explainable now and understandable. That part that really embraces the concept of consequence is one of the last parts to fully develop. So there is a reason that a lot of teenagers, even with the information, can't make the connection. If you do this, this is likely to happen.
Well, that's, you know, and I studied Michael Gurian's work. I do a lot. You know, I'm at Hopkins with, you know, Mr. President now, the brain surgeon. But to a mother like who's raising Shanae, she can care less about some brain research.
Yeah.
I understand it.
Oh, yeah.
And but we have to have the conversation to say that, well, understand, they're making these decisions because their brains aren't fully developed. As a researcher, I can say that, but you got to go a little deeper than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we, a lot of times, we sort of talk over individuals. And trying to talk to Shanae's mom and dad, like, well, listen, I'm not trying to hear that.
Yeah.
This girl needs to get it together. But the reality is there's some things that should have been in place that weren't in place. There's some conversation that should have happened a long time ago. It shouldn't have taken Shanae to get to where she got to in order for her to change herself around.
I guess what I'm not offering that is rationalization or excuse. It's an identification of the nature of the challenge here. And, you know, Glenn, you've been nodding your head, and I can tell leaning in you want to get into the conversation here. So, you know, in what ways then do we cope with that reality that in many ways they're just not going to be able to see consequence?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think when you boil Shanae's story down, at least for me, on the surface, there's something very simple here. We know that teenage kids between 3 and 6 p.m. are most likely to get in trouble during those hours because those are the hours they're unsupervised because often their parents are at work. So if they're not in some kind of after-school program where there is supervision and attention paid, they're going to find something to do. That's Shanae's story. Shanae also said something I think is very instructive. She said she was looking for attention. There was no supervision. Mm-hmm. Shanae was looking for boundaries. Mm-hmm. Kids thrive with boundaries. We have to know our children. We have to take the time to get to know our children. And on an individual basis, we need to look at the boundaries that they can and cannot respect and how we try to work with them time and again, and Lamar says in a positive fashion, to get them to understand what the boundaries are, what the consequences will be for not doing that. And it actually gives children not repression, but freedom then to live, because they know when they cross the line and when they don't. They have all this freedom in the area that's good, that's the good part. They know when they get to the boundary, that's where the consequence will come in. And so, you know, as we look at Shanae's story, I think those are some very basic takeaways that parents can come away with. And also, it's hard, John. We're all busy. We're working hard. We're bombarded by work and information at home on our phones and everywhere we turn. But we need to slow down and take time to sit with our children and talk to them and really find out what's going on. And even though you're thinking, I got to get dinner on and I got to get the dishes done, for your children, that all can wait. Mm-hmm. They need you. They need your attention. And they need you to pour that love into them. And when you develop those loving relationships through time and attention, that's where the fruits of this come out. And we as adults need to check ourselves and say, why is my 9-year-old not understanding this? Because he's 9 and I'm 50. So when we talk about that brain development piece, we need to think about, what does a 9-year-old need? Mm-hmm. And the only way we know that is by talking to our 9-year-old. They'll tell us. And somebody said this to me today, and this is the hardest thing for me. At that point, when you ask your child, what do you need, even though you think you know what they need, you have to bite your tongue and sit there in silence and let them answer, because they will. They'll tell you what they need. And Shanae told us what she needed at 12 years old, or 10 when she started getting into trouble. That's important for all of us. Those are the basic things we can take away from a very complex situation.
And also, her behavior really showed us what she need, because she didn't have the vocabulary to really explain it.
Yeah.
So then again, she's going to act out on everything that she, if she didn't have the vocabulary to actually do. And so that has a lot to do with brain development as well.
We've gotten another Facebook question from a listener named Katie. Again, if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. You can find us on Twitter at WFYI. You can send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org, or you can go old-fashioned and call us at 866-476-3881. Katie's question is, do you think CPS, Child Protective Services, can play a more involved role in helping these girls early on? I'll start with Glenn on that one. And since we're getting close on time, and I'm assuming we're going to start getting more of these questions, if we can be tight in our answers too.
That really depends on the situation that you find the caseworker in. And we know oftentimes they are overloaded with the work that they have, and it's really trying to hope that they can understand what resources are available to them in the community and taking a good look and making referrals. And oftentimes, making sure that decisions are made in the community is the best way, because people in that community can best find the resources to try to help those individuals. So we know, especially as we look around the state, there are model programs that do that, that in local communities, they're trying to make the best decisions for girls and boys both, and really tying them into local resources, because that's how you get children to connect to home, if home is the community.
I think CPS in most cities, I think the system is broken. And the reason why I think that it's broken is because many of the people are ill-equipped to deal with the issues that Shanae is really, really dealing with, because many of the people that are working for these organizations, they have never walked, they've never worn her shoes. And you have this theoretical piece, but then you have to have this, the reality of what's going on. And so as I look across the country, that system has been broken. That's why I look at organizations like IYI that's pouring into other organizations that are sort of picking up the mantle, where some of these larger, it's a bureaucracy. I mean, it's a government program that, again, is tied into funding and things of that nature. And if the people are ill-equipped, then they're not going to be as effective as they could be.
John, real quick, if I can make a point.
And then, well, I want to get to Shanae. I want to ask.
I certainly do. And one of the things we're starting to see now in these model programs across the state is that instead of the bureaucracy or the organization reaching you know, the people coming to them because their child is in trouble. Now we're starting to see, especially sometimes in schools or other organizations, where they're going to meet parents and children in their homes and in their places with home visits and those sorts of things. Because the only way those connections are going to be made that Lamar says are broken is getting into those situations and seeing what the reality is. And so that's one way we're seeing some of those model programs work. And they're not always – oftentimes they're public-private coalitions that are working and sharing resources in a community is by really seeing what resources are available in that community, but then going and meeting people. Because oftentimes people in these situations are not comfortable going to the school and asking for help because they had a bad experience in school.
Yes.
So if the school comes to them and meets them on their in their place, that oftentimes can break down those barriers and start the communication that is so vital to solving some of these issues.
And Shanae, I want to go back to that that period before, you know, the violent incident, you know, the stabbing at when you were 12 years old and your parents had taken you. You know, picking up on what we've heard here, those interventions weren't successful. What did you need to hear at that point? What might have been effective at that point with you?
For me, I needed to be around someone who I felt like really cared. Who I felt like really had that time and attention for me. There was a time, at one point, my mom, she just got to a point, and it wasn't that she didn't love me, but I believe that with all of her heart, she thought that giving up custody of me is what would help me because I just wouldn't stay home. So she did take me to social services, and she left me there, and I was put into a foster home where I had been trying to get forever because I thought that I was going to get all of this attention in foster home. And I wound up in a place where I kept the same night clothes on for weeks without being able to change clothes. You know, the same and again, and I don't mean to seem like I'm overemphasizing, but I think that we need to get it in our minds that a lot of our young women are not safe anywhere, not even in CPS sometimes, you know. And so some of those things didn't work because I was still in the same situation with those quote unquote interventions as I was on the outside. So I think that just what changed and what was the biggest thing that I needed was those people who really loved us, who really cared, who really sat down with us as if we were their own family, as if we were their own children and had those boundaries. We knew that we could not overstep those boundaries. They had that love. They had those conversations. And they just had that care and concern. They changed a lot of our lives.
And I don't want to leave people because we've talked about a lot of very desperate and in some ways depressing things here. I want to leave people with a little bit of hope, Shanae, because your life is now in an entirely different place. Could you
yes.
talk about where your life is now in this little bit of time we have left?
Yes. Well, I have three amazing babies. I have, ironically, a daughter who is 12 years old. I have a daughter who's 10 and a son who's 9. And I just try to be as active as I can with them. I take them to church. I bring them with me sometimes on my speaking engagements. I travel along with Lamar sometimes across the country speaking to other young women about and youth workers about what I've gone through. And I'm also working on a book called From Girlhood to Womanhood that'll be out soon.
And Glenn, real quickly, in just a few seconds here, if people do want to attend the conference, how do they go about doing that?
The Marriott Hotel tonight on Maryland Street. Check in at 6. Movies from 6:30 to 8:30 with panel discussion with Lamar and Shanae. Again, it has some serious content. If you want to bring a teenage girl with you, that's fine. But we say you need adult supervision for your teenager. And tickets are free, probably only less than 100 left. So on a first-come, first-served basis, tonight at the Marriott Hotel downtown on Maryland, check in at 6 o'clock.
Well, I'd like to thank my guests, Glenn Augustine, Lamar Shields, and most of all, Shanae Watkins, for joining us for this wonderful conversation. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.